Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories for this very special interview with Richard Dutcher, the father of Mormon cinema. I'm John DeLynn. Please bear with me while I make four short but very important announcements with regard to this interview. First, these interviews are not only available in audio format, they're also available in high-definition video with footage from Richard's actual movies at youtube.com/mormonstories. Please check them out if you can. They're quite amazing. Historical, even. Second, Richard is in critical need of support for his current film project called Triptych, so please visit the website kickstarter.com during the month of October 2010 to donate. Kickstarter is a site created to help fund creative endeavors, but it requires that the funding target be completely raised before any funds change hands. Each project is given a particular number of days to reach its funding goals. In this case, it's 30 days, so time is of the essence. To learn more about the Triptych project, listen to this full interview or visit the site and type in Triptych. Triptych is spelled T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H and or Richard Dutcher. That's kickstarter.com, K-I-C-K-starter.com. We will also have a link to Richard's Triptych fundraising page at richarddutcher.com. For those of you who do not own Richard Dutcher's movies, such as God's Army, Brigham City, or States of Grace, please consider supporting Richard's incredible filmmaking by buying the DVDs today at richarddutcher.com. That's D-U-T-C-H-E-R. These movies are fantastic, and you will enjoy these Mormon Stories interviews so much more if you've actually seen the movies. I can't recommend these movies highly enough. Finally, if you'd like to make a gift or investment to help Richard with one of his much larger film projects, including his much-discussed Joseph Smith movie, please contact him through richarddutcher.com or via Facebook. Again, the last name is spelled D-U-T-C-H-E-R. Let's do our part to help him make that Joseph Smith movie. It's his birthright. Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Take it away, Dan Witherspoon.
Okay, so for those who haven't seen States of Grace, God's Army 2, again, I don't know what, in your own brain, which do you use, God's Army 2?
I call it States of Grace.
States of Grace, okay. So we'll call it States of Grace the rest of the way. Those who haven't seen it, give us the quick setting and the overview of sort of the themes that it's covering. And
yeah, States of Grace is the story. We go back to Los Angeles for, back to the same mission.
Same mission with a couple of the same missionaries.
Right, and my concept with the film was to take the supporting characters of the first film and make them the supporting characters in the second film, and then but have kind of bring in new lead characters, which I thought would be, I couldn't really place another film that had done that, and I wanted to make a sequel that was better than the original, and I think I did, by the way. I think it's a better film, and it made so much less money. But it goes back to the same mission. New story takes the story of a Latino elder who you learn was formerly a gang member and then kind of brings him together in a very dramatic way with a young black gang member. And you see that and the Latino elder is thinking that his mission's largely been a failure. He's not a very good missionary. And he's just basically biding time till he goes home. And then he happens to get caught in this gunfight, a gang flare-up. And finds himself thrust together with this young black kid who's in a gang, and they start a friendship and start to change each other. It's also, there's a young Idaho missionary. I think he's from Idaho. Did I say he's from Idaho? Or,
I think so.
Or
yeah,
because
I think his parents come from Idaho towards the end of the movie, yeah.
Who's the companion, and he's got his own arc to tell. He's very young, very black and white thinker, and the movie kind of takes him places where the gray starts to, come forward. And that's the one I thought was going to be the most controversial element of the story because, well, most people have seen it. Those who haven't, he begins a friendship with a young woman who lives next door, and it becomes more than a friendship. And then he has to deal with that. But one of the things I wanted to, and then there's also a Pentecostal street preacher who's a main character. I was drawing upon preachers that I knew as a child in
and in one of my favorite scenes, he grabs the Book of Mormon that's left around the missionary apartment, and he goes out and he's preaching from King Benjamin on his soapbox, raising money. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a fun one. Just as a side note, I was living in the apartment where we shot that. We were living in there while we were shooting there, and one night, middle of the night, I hear some guy out there, you know, and it's he's preaching scripture, and I go out on the balcony and look down, and sure enough, here's this homeless guy out there preaching, and people are going, "Shut up, you know, sit down." But it was like, wow, it was like this guy, I'd written the character, and then this guy in real life does it. It was crazy. Anyway, that's the story, and it was really, I felt like it was a really important story that had to be told. And again, this was another one where I had the story, but I didn't have the ending, and when I finally understood what the ending was, then I realized, okay, it's a movie that needs to be made. And so it was another one of those movies like Brigham City, and...
Yeah, you roll the dice at the end again. It has to work.
Yeah, and I was very happy with the film, and it was a difficult movie to make. Interestingly, what a little background on the story was, when I did get to make it, one of the reasons I made it was because, quite frankly, that was something I could get financed, because the first movie had done well, and at this point I was pretty much bankrupt because of the profit. And if I'd gone out trying to sell another LDS film, that would have been a tough sell at the time. And so I was just going out saying, I'm making God's Army 2. And honestly, that's the only way I could get the film financed, was because it was God's Army 2. And even then, it was tough. It was rough. In fact, I probably couldn't have done it except... I was struggling for financing. And again, this was... my life as a filmmaker, struggling for trying to make something beautiful, and you're just like fighting every day to keep Cheerios on the table for your kids. It's crazy. You know, if you're trying to make something beautiful, you should be able to at least, you know, be able to manage that. But so here I'm fighting for this. I'm having the hardest time. And this is one of my lowest points, actually, as a filmmaker and as an adult, was, and this had happened right after my loss of faith and belief. So I was already in a place where I just felt kind of lost in the universe. And I was still fighting to get this film made. And Larry Miller, who had become a friend of mine, and before I tell this story, I got to tell you, the story ends really well and reflects really highly on him. And he was just a wonderful man. I mean, I have nothing bad to say about him. Loved and respected him. But some weird confusion had happened, and I had heard that he was going to go off and make these Work in the Glory movies. And I had called him and said, "You sure you want to do this? Because it's expensive and the market's not really..." I didn't want to get in the middle and say, "Don't do this," but I was trying to give him all the information that he needed to make a wise decision. But he was really gung-ho about it, and his general authority was helping out and whatever, so they're all going to go. and then he did a press conference for Work in the Glory, and totally slandered me unintentionally. Somebody asked him, just like, "Well, aren't you making the Joseph Smith film with Dutcher? What are you doing making this one?" And he said something about Richard Dutcher, he just kind of went off into the sunset, and you know, I never heard anything. We did a press conference, never heard anything more. And I was just shocked. This was like, and it was so completely not true. It was like I had been sending him information constantly, calling him, trying to keep him involved, and I was just dumbfounded, you know. It's like it attacked my credibility and the whole thing. And it was really just awful. And so I went from being really depressed for a day to being really angry, you know. And I pick up the phone and I call him up, and we're swearing at each other on the phone. And I'm just like, this is messed up. And you know, he slams down the phone and. And then he goes and looks into his files, and then he calls,
out his daytimers and starts to see all these.
Yeah, and then he looks and he sees that I was right, that I'd been sending him all this stuff, and he'd been either ignoring it or been preoccupied with other things. But that's how the story is a happy ending, because he calls me up and he just says, "I looked into the files and you're absolutely right, and I totally misspoke, and I'll make this right." And I said, "Great, well, that's good." And then he said, "And what are you working on right now?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to get this God's Army 2 done, not getting very far." And he goes, "How much more money do you need?" And I said, "Well, I need about $500,000. And he said, "Okay, well, let's do it. Let's make it happen." So I think the only reason I was able to get God's Army 2 made was because Larry slandered me and felt bad about it, yeah. and so he wanted to make it up to me. Yeah. And so after that, I was like, Larry, just slander me any chance.
There you go. I'll keep good records. I trust that you keep good records and let it loose.
But no, it really yeah. spoke highly to. And then we met for dinner, and it was like, you know, he'd honestly just made a mistake and felt terrible about it and wanted to do whatever he could do to. And he was never comfortable with the story because it was pretty edgy for him, and he knew going in. I told him what it was going to be about, and he was never too excited about it, but he was willing to trust me and let me go do it. And I really thank a lot of him because of that experience.
If I were to pick a theme that you haven't quite talked about that I think is certainly prevalent there, it's the elder, the companion who, like you say, is a black and white thinker. He doesn't see the forest from the trees, you know, the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. And so he's learning that a little bit, but he's preaching grace,
right?
You know, and he's teaching it and he's telling everyone of God's love and anything can be forgiven and stuff like that.
He doesn't understand,
but he can't anymore. Understand it for himself. And so the scene at the end where he's finally at least getting a glimpse of it. It is so powerful. So I think that's great. And then if I were to pick a couple other things that I think you were definitely trying to take a shot at, and the main one besides letter of the law, spirit of the law, I think is this whole idea that it just needs to be eradicated from Mormon consciousness, and that's the idea of it's better to be dead than to be disgraced. Come home in a pine box rather than dishonored, or however it would right. be. And you clearly take aim,
right?
And you hit.
There's a few things I was trying to do. One thing, just structurally, I wanted to tell a story that where the character that you think's the main character, you know, it has a certain arc in a traditional story, and I wanted it to have that arc. But then I wanted there to be this other story that comes up and kind of arcs over it. So it's hard to kind of describe, but I wanted kind of the supporting story to kind of become the main story, and the main story to kind of become the supporting story.
It does.
And it was kind of fun to play with that just structurally and do it. Aside from that, there were things I wanted. It was the idea of grace. It was very forgiveness, grace, redemption, atonement, all that. It was very much in my mind, something I really wanted to talk about. And it's not spoken about enough, I think, in Mormon arts and letters, and so I wanted to just dive right into it. I was interested in bringing the cross into a Mormon story in a very real and powerful way, so that it's something that always disturbed me in Mormonism, that was, for some reason, the cross is somehow demonized.
Yeah.
I mean, it's actually demonized.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just kind of, it's like, can we get away from that? You know, let's just, I'm not trying to like make the cross a central image in Mormonism, although I don't think that would be bad. But I wanted to put, you know, throw that out there and just kind of use it in a positive sense and in a beautiful sense as a in the story. So that was interesting. I definitely took a shot at the. I always hated that story of the, and I've heard it replayed.
Oh no!
Of fathers or mothers saying, you know, we'd rather have you dead than come back dishonored from a mission or to commit a sin that's that serious. It's better that you'd be dead. It's like, that is so sick and so messed up. And what does that have to do with the atonement of Christ? You know that, and so I wanted to definitely bring that out, and I wanted to take a character to that extreme. You know, and what is that? What are the real life ramifications of someone who's been told that? You know, that he actually believes it's better for me to be dead
right.
than who I am right now.
And he ends up being proved right, at least about his father, holding to that in a very rigid way.
Yeah, somebody after seeing that film came to me and said, you know what, fathers don't come off too well in your movies. And I was like, yeah, that's true.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's kind of true. That's true.
Interesting. There's one more piece of that film that I just can't let pass, if it's all right with you. I want to talk more about violence and spirituality and their intersection and whatnot in Falling. The States of Grace has a lot of violence.
Right.
And there's a lot of spiritual stories, but you did to me, you didn't miss a chance. And to me, I'm so grateful that this chance. I mentioned I like Deshaun, who plays Elder Banks, and you have him come in just for one scene in this. But you do the most beautiful portrayal of the Book of Mormon, a teaching or a story from the Book of Mormon that fits so perfectly at the intersection of this gang member's who's trying to make a change. Are you willing to give any specifics about that, or maybe we can cut in? I mean, would you like to flesh out the scene? What story I'm talking?
Oh yeah.
To me, it's just absolutely from that baptismal interview scene to the very next scene, and what Carl does is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a story that I always loved from the Book of Mormon. The anti-Nephi Lehis and the burying of the weapons, you know, who committed murders and then they bury them and then are willing to be killed rather than take up their weapons again. But the whole, you know, visually, the whole burying of the weapons, especially in a mass sense, you know, they're burying their weapons, they're making a covenant, and then they're willing to die rather than break that covenant. And I don't even know how that came into the story, except it just organically came as I was writing it. And but then it was actually tricky. I remember being a little worried when I had this character actually going out into his backyard and digging a hole and putting his guns and knives
and his brass knuckles
into the hole. And I thought, this could be silly. I've got to be really careful how I do this because this could be really silly. But it ended up, I thought, being really nice. And especially when he goes and digs them up again, it's like, oh, this is getting good.
Yeah, but the performance of Elder Banks and the way you had him frame that entire thing, you can be a new man, you know? Yeah. There's grace right there. You've got that piece of grace.
Yeah, that's a line I've always liked. He says, you be a new man, in a few years he won't even remember the old one. Yeah. I like that line. Yeah. That's a good line.
Yeah, and another wonderful, I love J.J. Boone, who you've used again in a couple other films, just as this grandmother who, you know, certainly her own Christian faith, but anything that this grandson wants to do to change, she is 100% supportive of it. And no man is taller than when he's on his knees, and some of his knee lines. So again, for the viewing audience, the listening audience, for Mormon Stories, you've got to get States of Grace. So while we've got this chance, we've now done God's Army, Brigham City, and States of Grace. There's a 3-pack of DVDs that people can get at your website. Right. For how much money? Yeah. What does it cost to get all 3 of those films
together?
Frankly,
I don't know how much it costs, but it's a good deal, I'm sure.
So it'd be cheaper than buying them individually. But
But
it's the Dutcher collection, I think, is what you call it.
It's got the three films there. States of Grace was technically also it was interesting because I got to the point where there are a lot of things. You keep asking me about what I like about these films, and one of the things I really like about States of Grace is just some of the visual imagery. I had a little more, this time I had a little more time and money than I had in the past, and so I was able to take it was about the same budget that I had for Brigham City, but I was able to, I knew the pieces that I really wanted to concentrate on, and so some of the images, being able to execute some of the scenes, the scene where Carl was being confirmed a member of the church while his little brother's being attacked by a gang, that was such an important juxtaposition of scenes for me. And some of the imagery of his body in a fetal position, you know, wide with the red against the green, things like that just as a director were very important, and I see them now and I'm very happy that I'm very satisfied with them. And Carl at the ocean in the film, and of course the ending scene, and just so many things in this film, and so many of the performances were. I think it helped in this sense where I couldn't be in the movie because my character was dead in the first one, and so I was able to just concentrate completely 100% on the images, you know, and the performances. And so, you know, I see this film and I see Rachel Emmer's work and Lucas Fleischer as Elder Farrell and the whole cast.
Yeah,
J.J. Boone as the grandma was just phenomenal. Lamont, so many
Lamont
performances
Stevens,
were just fantastic. That it's a film that I really, that I'm very, very proud of. But I got to a point technically where I felt like, I mean, the film was very, to me as a director looking at it, it was very, very grounded, very solid, somewhat you know, traditional but beautiful, and it still had a feel of an independent film, but it was very, it was kind of a slick independent film. You know, I'd gotten to the point where I felt like technically I had a pretty good command of this. And that was right when I got to the point where it was like, okay, now I need to step away from this. I need to go in the opposite direction. I need something I need to deconstruct my technique a little bit because this is getting too clean. It's getting too nice.
Interesting.
And so that was one of the things about Falling where I had jumped into that. And it was like everything was different this time. It was like I wanted the film to be, you know, grainy, ugly, jumpy. I wanted the editing to be different. I never wanted it on a tripod. I wanted to just approach this film in a completely different way. I didn't want there to be any music in the film. It was just a complete different, right. I wanted to shoot it differently, even in the sense of, instead of just a traditional shooting, I wanted to have, you know, two or three cameras going simultaneously and, you know, cameramen bumping into each other, trying to catch the action. Right. And so that's where that came along. But also, the reason I did Falling was, like I said, I saw what was coming, and I realized that I had to get this film made. Falling was a film that
you had in mind. You said from God's Army, it was going to be next.
And one of the things, and this was a film that was just, I was literally carrying on my back in my mind. You know, it was like always speaking into my ear, like, when are you going to make me? And I was worried that I was going to be too old to do it, or the market was going to change. I would never get to do it. And so, and it literally, you know, was starting to, literally torment me a bit. It was like I was worried. I didn't even know why I had to make this movie, but I knew I had to make this movie. And so when I started doing States of Grace, I started financing States of Grace, I started to think, I'm going to be in L.A. I've got to do this as well. So
I've got a crew I like already hired. I'll extend it for a few weeks, right?
Right, right. And so I started to, what I did was I was start as I had States of Grace financed, and so I actually started to go ahead and cast the two films together at the same time. You know, so I was calling people in and putting them into one movie or the other while I was raising money for Falling. So it was a completely separate deal. The rumor mill had me told, you know, they, like I say, I made so many enemies by wanting to make the profit and by telling people that their movies were crap. When they saw that I was making two, there was rumors out there that I was using Larry's money to make two movies instead of one. And I was actually having to call Larry Miller and say, I'm not making another movie with your money. It's totally separate. But it got to that point where I was actually having to do damage control with my own investors. But I was raising money for this other film, and I was, you know, using the two films to help each other. It's like, okay.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper when I've already got people.
Exactly.
And catering, like, service, everything's done.
It's like, you already agreed to do this film. Will you do this one, but at a better price? Same thing with Labs and all this kind of stuff. It was helping each other out. So that was the plan, is I knew I had to take that opportunity because I might not, I knew I wouldn't get the chance to make it again. And I knew I would always, to the end of my life, I would regret it. And it was artistically as well as just professionally, I just had to make this film. So
tell the story. I mean, this is your, obviously, your most controversial film. And
so far.
Yeah. So.
It came about because it came about while I was raising money for God's Army. I was getting very frustrated. It was taking forever. And every day it was just me pounding the pavement, you know, making calls, and I was getting sick of it. And so I actually, it came about in the sense that one day I just said, I'm so sick of it. I can't do this anymore. I've got to do something creative, and maybe I'm not even going to be able to raise, you know, 300 grand, 250 grand to make God's Army. And so if I end up and I've only got 20 grand, what could I do with it? So I had a little office in Burbank in a tiny little building, and I went in one day and I just closed the door and pulled the drapes, and I knelt and prayed, and I mean, it was very sincere, and I said, if there were one film, you know, that you'd want me to make, what would it be? And that's what I'm going to work on for the next couple of days. It's like, if there's one film, you know, that you'd want me to make. I mean, I hadn't even shot God's Army yet, but it was just like a completely separate from the marketplace, from anything, what do you want me to make? And then I got up, sat down at my desk, and this just poured out. I mean, it was like I wrote this thing so quickly, and it had been I'd been toying around with a couple ideas over the previous few years. One of them was about a stringer, which was a guy these guys that run around Los Angeles and New York, I guess, trying to find disasters or crimes or trying to videotape these things so that they can sell the footage to the news stations. And I thought, and I'd seen a like a Frontline or something like that episode about these guys, and had become fascinated with it. So I was thinking of what kind of story could I tell them there, and then I was also playing with the idea, just this person undergoing a spiritual transformation, much like I had undergone after Girl Crazy. And so I was writing that spiritual, and then when I thought about combining the two, they both really came alive, and I was like, oh, this is it. And so when I realized that the two could work together, then it was suddenly about a stringer who was having a spiritual transformation, but he had also set in motion. What happens is he videotapes the murder of a gang murder, and sells it. And then, of course, so the images are, you know, televised worldwide, and the police are looking for the gang members, but they haven't caught them yet. While the police are looking for the gang members are looking for whoever took the video. and also, he's married to an actress who, and they're both lapsed Mormons, right? And so.
Their integrity is being challenged by their career choices.
Right.
Yeah, so they're making, they're sacrificing their integrity.
Right. Both. So they're dealing in this really, you know, touchy area where they're, you know, making moral or professional decisions and moral decisions and good, you know, mostly bad decisions. But and anyway, this story summed up a lot of what I was feeling spiritually at the time, how I was feeling about Hollywood at the time.
Yeah, and, the line about I want Meryl or whatever. Yeah, just Hollywood was demanding, just pump up the volume. I've seen that before. Two steps uglier.
And so that's the basic story, and I jumped into it. I want to do it very realistically. And so we finished States of Grace. We finished shooting States of Grace. And the money that I was trying to raise, I hadn't raised yet. And so we had to take a break. So we were down for about 6 weeks while I continued to try to raise money and had someone else trying to help raise money. And then eventually we had enough to shoot. So pulled everything together again and went out and shot. And there's a lot to... I mean, this movie... People ask me what my favorite film is, and it is this. I mean, this is my favorite film. It's my most personal film. It was my riskiest film. It was the film that I almost went crazy on because I was so, again, you know, I was at the same point where putting every dime into this movie, and I was opening up in certain ways, and the experience of making States of Grace had been really difficult. You know, I'd been away. By the time I made Falling, I'd been away from home about 5 months, and was broke except for what I could pay myself while I was working on these films. And I was working, you know, these 16, 18-hour days. It was insane, and I was just spending myself in every way, every resource, whether it was emotional, you know, physical, emotional, spiritual, financial. It was all being spent, and so it was the most painful movie I've ever made, and the people that were really close to me while I was making it were aware of that. Crick works with me on just about every film, he was aware, and some of the other, Virginia Reese was aware, the actress, there were a few people who were aware that I was really walking a fine line here, and wow, what a story.
Let me go back and clarify one thing, so I don't want you to lose your track there, but you said it expressed what you were feeling at the time, and I think you were talking about that being the time you were filming it, all the frustrations with Hollywood and the various things. But you wrote this back at God's Army time, and so I think even though the main character in Falling is having, he's in a spiritual crisis, you probably weren't in a spiritual crisis at the time you wrote it, were you?
No.
So yeah, it's more so let's clarify those kinds of things. So.
No, it was, and I've talked about this a little bit, where it was like collaborating with, because I wrote the film at a certain place in my life, shot the film when I was at a certain place. This was after my loss of belief. So I was at a certain place there, and then and then after we finished shooting, I was editing States of Grace, releasing States of Grace, then I finally was able to go back and work on Falling. So that was even a couple of years after I'd shot it, whereas by that time I had come into more peace with my life, my spiritual journey. So yeah, it was very interesting because it was like collaborating with myself, but at different points stages, in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fascinating.
Well, I remember you and I really became friends during the fundraising process for God's Army Two States of Grace.
Right.
And you were, I felt a real kinship with you. We were both, we were having our eyes were a lot wider open to
right.
the good, bad, and the ugly. But you know, it was we mostly connected over interest in Eastern approaches to spirituality and
right.
and things. That's the base of our friendship. So I can testify that you were not anti-Mormon at the time. You hadn't made full decisions.
Oh no!
And this is when you're raising money.
Well, I'm not. I've never been anti-Mormon.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So.
No. So I. It was. That was another one where it was interesting because by the time I was shooting the film, I was in a little different place, and even though the script didn't change hardly at all.
Yeah, I can see this script coming out of a faithful person.
Yeah,
because it is a chicken's coming home to roost. If you've set your life in a certain motion, things are gonna. There's consequences to yeah. every action.
Yeah, and it's a very, very moral film. Even though a lot of people have a hard time recognizing that because
it's so violent.
Because it's a very violent film and very, it's got a grit to it and a realism that you don't expect. But yeah, I think it's a very moral film. It's a tragedy. I mean, it's very, in a classic sense, it's quite a tragedy. So I think, and tragedies are moral. I mean, they just are. So yeah, that was the process. What was I talking about before? I was talking a little bit about deconstructing. So if you watch the film, you'll notice how, I mean, I think you'd be very surprised how stylistically different it is from States of Grace, Virgin
sure.
City. I mean, very different, but I was very happy with it. And oddly, I found that there are some images that, where I feel some of the most beautiful images I've ever shot. And, but while I was deconstructing the image, that's a weird word, but maybe while I was trying to basically uglify, I was trying to show Los Angeles to be the ugly place that I often feel it to be. And so, but while I was trying to make it ugly, I often at times, you know, hit upon these beautiful things. And, so there are things that when I see the film still, I just look at them and the way the colors and the shadows and everything, it's like, wow, that's a gorgeous shot. And I love I love grain in a film. And so some of the images in it with the grains and the colors and the shadows, it's beautiful.
Well, and it's interesting what you're saying. You were dialoguing with different parts of yourself. The character, he meets his younger self at various
true.
Points of the film. And you know, the innocence that he had at one time versus where he's at now. And one of the things that you made the choice to do is leave this character and his spiritual as well as physical end still a question mark.
Well, I don't think it's much of a question.
Okay,
but
so you don't have him. There's no hope.
Well, there's a little bit of an ambiguity there, but I mean I know for me what happens, but I don't I allow the viewer to
yeah.
you know come up with an alternate ending if that's the way they want it to end. It's like okay, it can end that way too. That's fine. But what you're talking there is something that we've talked for hours now, so I'm trying not to leave anything out, but one of the things about the process, one of the most fascinating things about the process of making Falling was watching it evolve. Like I say, I was editing a couple of years after I had shot the film, and whether it was the writing, whether it was the directing, whatever, I was investing everything I had in it, but I always had the feeling that I was searching for something, I was exploring that I hadn't quite nailed it yet, and I didn't know exactly what it was. And it was in the editing of the film, the final stage of editing, where I was actually getting ready to shoot Evil Angel, and I had an editing suite in the hotel across, and so I was going, you know, from Evil Angel work to step in to oversee the final editing on Falling. And it was finally at that point when I realized how the movie had to end and what the whole movie was about, basically. I'd been, you know, trying to find it in the editing, and finally it clicked. And so we actually went back after I shot Evil Angel, went back and shot a little bit more of Falling so that I could make it work the way that I realized, when I realized what the movie was all about. And that's something that just doesn't happen. You don't have that opportunity in filmmaking. Usually, you know, you've got a script, and then you go out and you shoot the script, and then you edit what you've shot with the script, and it's all just there. You know, you're just realizing a script. With this, the script really was just the beginning, and it continued to evolve through the direction of it, and then it continued to evolve in the editing. And I was able to have the luxury, because I had some very patient and supportive investors, a patient and supportive investor, I was able to take the time to find the movie and then go back and film what needed to be completed. So I was shooting on the thing 2 years after I had finished principal photography and then getting it ready to go out. So that was just the artistic process was interesting. And I'd love to be able to do that. And I'm starting to kind of create projects where I can do that same thing, where it's a little more of an exploratory process. And I'm able to explore things that are very important to me.
You know, would you say that Triptych, what you're doing now, Triptych is one of these that you're talking about?
Triptych
in that
is
way.
Absolutely one of these things. One more thing I want to talk about Falling before we leave.
I've got two things myself.
Okay. So. but it's like 3 days into shooting, I decided I was the wrong person to play this part. And I was like, I thought I'm screwing this up. I'm totally screwing this movie up. I was very focused on the fact that, I'm not a Tom Cruise, Matt Damon. I'm not the handsomest guy in the world. And I knew that I could do the spiritual things I needed to do and the personal things that, you know, could deliver. But I thought I was just nobody was going to see this movie. I was explaining to Virginia Reese, the actress in it, one day. I was having a little crisis, and we went for a little walk, and I was saying, I shouldn't be in this movie. You know, I should be playing a supporting character or something. And there was this other guy that I had auditioned who actually played Virginia's brother in the movie, but I thought he'd be perfect. I should cast him. He should be the guy. And she was saying, no, you're doing great. Just stick with it. You know. And anyway, but what I was thinking about, what finally made the decision was, I was into this thing driving to the set every morning where I was listening to Warren Zevon. For whatever reason, that was the music for me in this period. And I was listening to some Willie Nelson, but mostly Warren Zevon. And I started to think, it's like, wow, these are guys with such unique voices that nobody would find them and say, you know, they would never win American Idol. They would never be signed to a contract. Because their voices are so different, so unique, but that's what makes that contributes a lot to what makes their music powerful, and so singular, you know. Especially Willie Nelson, he's like, you know, a Willie Nelson song when it's on. And that's actually one thing that helped me make the decision to continue, you know, playing the part. It's like, okay, I'm not going to be the most handsome guy, you know. And this is going to be a little bit different take than somebody else would give, but it's going to be me. It's going to be my take. It's going to be my performance, and it's going to be different than what anybody else would do. And it's just as valid as, you know, if Matt Damon were doing it. So gave me the confidence that, you know, I mean, yes, I am a self-confident person, but you get in these extreme situations, and it gave me a little the self-confidence that I needed to continue to make this crazy project.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. That's fun.
Yeah. But it is, it's my favorite film, and it hasn't been seen much. And
that's where I was going to go next, and then I want to talk about violence and spirituality.
Okay.
So tell me, you've indicated in the last month that you don't plan to make this available anytime soon. Let's say it that way.
Yeah, I'm always telling people that it's back in the vault, and it is back in the vault. I mean, I actually have a vault, and it does go back in the vault. And so I tell people that it's never going to be available, but here's the secret. So, no, it will. In fact, it was always designed to go after Evil Angel, because I knew that if I just put it out on its own, nobody would go. I kind of tested the waters with that, with a week in Salt Lake and a week in L.A., and that's exactly what happened. Nobody came. So I pulled it and was going to just piggyback it on Evil Angel so that it could come out afterwards as, you know, from the director of Evil Angel and all that. But I've been, you know, slowed down on Evil Angel. So no, the vault thing is part just BS on my point, trying to build a little mystique and a little demand, because I do very much want people to see it. But I don't just want to throw it out there on the marketplace and sell a couple thousand DVDs and have that be it. So that's the challenge. Again, it's mostly just been the challenges of having the sufficient financing to get the movie out in the way that it deserves, you know, to be seen. So hopefully, no, it won't be stuck in the vault forever.
Okay. So there's hope for listeners who eventually want to see it.
Oh, yeah.
But we do need to let them know this is completely unlike... I mean, all four of your first films deal with violence in some way, but this is very graphic, very bloody. In fact, one of the writers says, I wish Brigham City, or one of the question people, I want Brigham City to have more blood. This one, they probably, most people have challenged exactly how bloody this is, and especially this one pivotal fight scene that just goes on forever and ever and
comes
over the top. You've talked articulately about that decision in the past.
I wanted to show the difference between, well, violence as depicted in movies and television is often so phony. And I think a lot of the problems that we have with this, this idea of being desensitized to violence comes from the fact that violence isn't portrayed in a very realistic or powerful way. And this really hit home to me one time when I was in L.A. and I was in a restaurant. It was actually a restaurant that we shot. There was a jumper scene where a guy jumps off a building and, you know, he splats right out in front of the restaurant where I was. I was just sitting there eating a hamburger, talking to some people. And a fight, I mean, some guy just suddenly got up and started punching another guy. And it was pretty close to us, you know, just probably 12, 15 feet away. And the ugliness of the fight was so, I mean, it was really nauseating. You know, it was real violence where some guy was actually pounding into another man's face. And, you know, they carried it on outside and the cops came and everything. But it was a real reminder of just how sickening real violence is. You know, if you were to see something like that on TV, you wouldn't think anything of it. You just keep eating your popcorn or whatever. But to be that close to it...
I mean, you'd be able to do it because they wouldn't portray it as realistically as
well. Yeah, because it wouldn't come across. Okay. The ugliness wouldn't come across.
Yeah, you don't want to be eating your popcorn during the falling
No, I couldn't finish my meal after this
experience. Right, okay. So experience. Deliberately.
And then, you know, that reminded me of all the actual violence that I have seen and experienced. And it is so... so ugly and so disturbing. And I wanted, and this was a movie that I was making about this man who lives in this very violent lifestyle.
A good day is when he sees a bloody crime to film.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so it was important to me at the climax of this film to have, when the violence comes home to roost, as you pointed out, it had to be sickening. It had to be real. And so I went... and basically looked at, you know, all the what is it about the approach of a Hollywood film or a TV show that makes it meaningless, that makes it without real impact, and that makes it kind of exciting and glamorous. And I started to strip away all those things. So again, the music was gone, the effects were different, the length of it, what I was showing, just everything about it, I approached from a new way, and the entire point was to make people just physically ill. And to feel the ugliness, at least to get as close as I possibly could to that feeling of the real ugliness of violence.
Yeah, I don't want to just see the bone. I want to see the marrow oozing from the center of the bone. Yeah.
That you have come to like in some respect and care about, and to watch him in this situation was... And so it was meant to be sickening, and so when people have said that it was sickening and that I went overboard, it's like, oh, good, I succeeded, because you were meant to be disturbed and sickened. And so did I push it too far? Maybe only in one shot that I, watching the film recently, and there was one slow motion shot during the fight scene that I wouldn't do again. Because it was.
Would
just,
you take it out between now and the next release?
No, the movie's done. It's in. It's the way it is. But there's probably only one shot that I would have taken out.
Well, one particular listener sent in a whole bunch of great questions. So let me at least read his question on this one, and I think this is the right spot. And he says, each of your first four films focused on both redemption or its absence, and violence. In your view, is the relationship? What's the relationship between
those two things. Is violence a necessary component to personal, spiritual, or religious redemption? And then do you see this combining of violence and spirituality as a theme in your work? So those would be kind of
first of all, I should clarify, yeah, that Girl Crazy was actually my first film. So
oh, that's right.
And I didn't really deal with violence.
Your first four, your Mormons.
Right. That just dealt with me getting to kiss a lot of women. Yes, it's violence and redemption and is definitely a recurring theme in my work. It's interesting. I never really thought about what would be recurring themes in my work until I saw them. I mean, my realization of what Falling was about suddenly clicked when I realized, oh, this is something that I keep going back to. This innocence, loss, this destruction of this violation of innocence, something that I keep going back to, and it's often violence that violates the innocence. That's definitely a part there. Is it a necessary part? I think life can be so violent, and not just like a tiger eating some other smaller animal, but just emotionally violent. I mean, life is, at least in my experience from a very young child, life was very violent emotionally. You know, it's like a lot of pain. You know, and you learn to be happy in the pain because it doesn't ever go away. Really, you can lessen it. I found that a lot of my personal, I found in life, separate from art, a lot of my own personal epiphany, that's kind of a soft word to use, but my own personal understanding, moments of real perception, clarity, understanding, growth, my moments of real growth as a human have been usually after some very emotionally violent experience. And I've had a lot of, I think I'm very affected by violence, which is why I keep going back to it,
Part of spiritual growth is your normal story has to be disrupted somehow. There has to be an opening to where previous theories and views have never, I've got to expand my story to incorporate this level of stuff. So I can see exactly what you're saying. If it's violence, it could be other things, but somehow or other your everyday life has to be ripped open a little bit probably to really welcome in the rush of insight.
It's when your mind and your heart and your soul is torn. Yeah. It's literally torn, and then it's in the process of healing, I guess it's the scar tissue that that's what's really valuable. So I've definitely noticed that,
a deliberate theme that you'd sent out to do.
Oh, no.
It's when it's pointed out or when you notice it yourself.
No, I've never had, as a person, I'm very affected by violence. As a child, I saw so much, my father and mother were, their arguments were not, calm intellectual debates. There's a lot of throwing and fighting. And that stuff leaves a mark, that leaves a, and also growing up I was a little kid, I matured late, and so I was always one of the littlest kids in class, and I was always moving to a new school because of my dad's businesses, and so I was always fighting, I was always having to prove myself, and so I think that probably contributed to that, and having to fight even though I was sickened by it. Violence, I don't know how you can tell stories without violence, and I think it's something that's very important to examine and to explore. I think, that kind of irresponsible violence is irresponsible, and it's funny that people don't have a problem with that. It's like nobody has a problem with, Magnum PI and people, poom, 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 poom. But with Falling, when you're really looking at it the way that trying to look at it the way that it really is, people have a problem with it. So.
Yeah. Well, and you look at Christianity, the whole story centers on a very violent act. Redemption and grace and spiritual stuff has flown out from that crevice or that intersection.
And I really honestly don't understand. There's a disconnect for me as a storyteller, I think, because to me, I know that it's a story, and I'm constructing it from the very beginning through the words and the images and the performances and the editing, everything. And so to me, I don't really, when people come to me and say, your movie's too violent, I kind of look at them with a little, I don't really understand that. You know, it's like, no, it's not. Go look at it again and understand what it's about. And it's not. But again, you're dealing with people that are very illiterate, you know, which is crazy. You know, it's a society, our entire society is so media-driven and image-driven, and yet we're so illiterate about storytelling, images and storytelling and media. So it's fascinating to me that people respond and just
consume without thinking.
Yeah,
we're being manipulated and shaped without reflection. Okay, one last total. This is like 30 seconds. Prop in the somebody has asked, what is with the Krista statue that's in the front of your offices here? And that comes from a replica that you needed to have made for Falling, right?
Right.
One of the most powerful scenes in the movie takes place at the foot of the Krista statue.
Right, right. The Krista is a very central, the scenes with the Krista are very central to the film Falling. So I had to have, there was no way in hell I was going to get permission to go shoot on temple grounds. So I had to recreate a temple grounds, and I had to recreate the Krista. So I actually had a Krista statue made. And now I've got this big 9-foot Jesus that I don't know what to do with. I keep trying to sell it, but so that's what it is. It's just, and it's a beautiful sculpture.
It is,
so
yeah.
I just love it. But yeah, it causes a lot of confusion.
It's like, yeah, and that particular one, because its presence in Mormon visitor centers,
right?
You know, that's, you know, this isn't Falling. It's almost incidental that he's Mormon, the main character, and that they are. But that. Adds, that's one of the pieces that gets added back in, that this is a Mormon.
Right.
You know, this image that so many Mormons are inspired by, he's looking up and pleading for grace and for something from this being.
A lot in there where, you know, the character being a lapsed Mormon and having been a serious Mormon, you know, a missionary and everything, that's part of his psychology, you know. So it was bringing in these iconic Mormon symbols was important to the character and therefore to the story and all that. So.
Great. Falling. Eventually, people see it.
Yeah, I hope
please,
so.
We'll have a chance. So. The current movie that is seeking an audience, it's playing at festivals right now,
right,
is Evil Angel. Tell us your theory that led to you to all of a sudden make just a fun horror flick.
Well, there's a
with,
lot.
Of course, some spiritual themes. But.
Right, right. Well, there's a lot to it and a lot behind it. One of the things was simply, one of the fringe benefits of making the film was it was so much fun after having made these four very personal, very meaningful films, was to be able to go and just have some fun. You know, I mean, just absolutely have some fun. You know, get to do stunts and special effects and a scary movie and have a decent budget, and I mean the whole thing was just fun to do. But it actually came about now some people are going to think I'm very cynical, and I don't think I'm cynical. I think I'm just being very realistic about it. But as I mentioned before, as my films got better, and I do think they did get better, I think Falling was my best film, and as they got better, they made the least money. People were less interested, and the Mormon cinema movement had pretty much died away. That wasn't really a market anymore. And it was so very important for me to continue making these movies. I mean, to me, Falling was, as far as I was able to get down that trail, that particular trail, and it was very methodical. It was God's army led to this, to this, to this, to Falling. And I wanted so very much to continue, because that kind of filmmaking where it's really an exploration, and the film itself helps me to progress spiritually and as a human being, and which leads to the next film and the next film. It's become something of a necessary, almost an addiction, where it's like I've got to keep growing, and this is the way that, for whatever reason, this is how it works for me, more so than. Anything, you know, maybe I could get the same thing out of writing, just writing purely novels, but whatever, this process is very important to me. And I saw it dying away, and I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. And so there are lots of ways I'm thinking, how do I continue to do this? I've got seven kids. I've got a family. I've got a small company. I've got to support this, but I want to keep making movies. But it looks like I want to keep making movies that aren't going to make any money and that 12 people are going to see. And even though those are the films that are the reason that I'm alive, nobody's going to pay for them. And how's that going to work? And so that's actually where Evil Angel came from. It was like I just poured out my heart and soul on States of Grace and Falling, and I'd watched as people just stayed away in droves and didn't care, shrugged. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, just shrugged. And I thought, and I realized, okay, if I keep doing this, I'm not going to make any more films. This is it. And I had an investor who had seen my other films and actually was interested in helping me get the Joseph Smith film made. And so he actually, you know, asked a few friends, said I'd really like to see that Joseph Smith film made. They knew me. We got together. We started to talk. We became friends. And he didn't have the money to put in to make a whole Joseph Smith film, but he definitely wanted to make a film with me. And so I immediately loved him, of course. But I was not going to, and that's the other thing, with seeing the way things were going, there was no way I could go to an investor and say, this is going to make money, this is a good bet, and which is very sad, you know, that was very sad. And so I just knew I could not do that with integrity. And anyway, so he wanted to make a film, and so I said, okay, I'm going to give you a couple options. One is I can do it. He loved States of Grace, you know, he loved Brigham City, God's Army. I said, we can make another one of those films. Can absolutely do that. If that's what you want to do, I will absolutely make one of those films. But I got to tell you right up front, I explained the marketplace, what was happening. I explained what had happened with States of Grace, was happening with States of Grace. And I said, we can absolutely do that. Or here's another story. And I told him the Evil Angel story. And I said, and it's not, you know, it's not really meaningful. It's not, you know,
particularly personal.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just going to be a lot of fun, and I think it's going to make a lot of money, and it's going to make enough money that I can, you know, I don't have to spend your money to make some personal film. I'll be able to spend my own money, which I'm perfectly willing to lose, to make something that's meaningful to me. And so that's actually where it came from. It was just simply a decision. It's like nobody wants to see the films that I want to make. Therefore, I'm going to make the kind of films that they want to see and then make enough money at it that I can make the kind of films that I want to make and not lose money for anybody. Because to me, losing money on a film and disappointing an investor who's put in, it just makes me sick. I mean, literally physically ill. Because every time I've gone into a film, I've gone in believing that it's actually going to make money. And when I've been wrong, it's just painful. Yeah, devastating. It's awful. So that's where that came along. And so Evil Angel came. But I loved making it. You know, it wasn't like, all right, I'll go do this one for them so I can make one for me. It was just like, I can do this too. I love doing it. And I actually did have a great time with it. And it was an opportunity for me to explore stylistically, do things that I had never been able to do before, to be able to play as a craftsman. Because there are certain things that you just can't do in a spiritual drama. Certain things you can't do with the camera or with the editing or, you know, you just...
Yeah.
And you can't do it. And so it was fun to be able to go where basically I could open up the whole toolbox and I could play with every tool that was there. And so I had a blast. I had an absolute blast. And from a moral point of view...
And you got to film it in Salt Lake City. That was a bonus.
I got to film it in Salt Lake City. Close to my family and close to a lot of people that I love to work with, and had a blast. But I was also able to do something that was something I hinted at earlier in this 8-hour conversation, but but that was there's a part of filmmaking that's an exploration, and there's only a couple things that I've ever done in film. But Evil Angel was one of them. It was like, okay, here's an opportunity, and I had left the church. Not publicly by the time I was shooting it. I think publicly it was right after I finished filming. But I had left, and so there were things that were concerning me, things I wanted to play with. Well, by saying that, I mean emotionally, I had lost my belief a few years before, but I hadn't publicly come to the point where I was telling people about it until after Evil Angel. But the point being, while I was making Evil Angel, there were certain things that now that I was freed from a certain cultural expectation, I knew that you know, as far as the things that we're told that we should never play with as artists, you know, as filmmakers, we should never, you know, the profanity, the nudity, the violence, even though I'd pretty much done a great job on the violence, but just pure exploitation violence or gore or whatever, something I hadn't really gone into in Falling. But these were all things that now I was interested in. I was like, I wanted to see if they were wrong, you know? A lot of people don't understand this when I try to explain it, but it's like, I had to find out, you know, I just had to find out. And again, I could make a film, and if I shot a nude scene and I thought it turned out to be dirty or perverted or wrong, then I wouldn't include it, you know, and I'd repent or whatever and go on about my business. Same with profanity, same with violence or whatever. So, and so I made this film, and yes, there's a lot of there's a lot of nudity in it, and there's a lot of violence in it, a lot of just graphic, gratuitous violence, a lot of profanity. Basically, I just you know, let it go where it would go, and
but
then
it still fits within the genre of your typical slasher Halloween horror
sure.
movie, right?
Is there
more nudity, more violence, more profanity than something that would fit into that market niche?
No, I don't think so. And I hope that it's a lot more intelligent than most of the stuff that you get in that genre. But the point being, it was an experiment. And it was actually interesting that afterwards, and to be quite frank about it, I mean, there, you know, it was basically a couple of scenes of full nudity. And the interesting thing to me was when I was on the set, when I was actually directing the scene, would it feel wrong? And I have a pretty good moral sense and I'm a pretty sensitive person in the sense that I feel, you know, when I do something wrong, I feel pretty immediately and pretty, you know, pretty strongly, and I feel really bad about it and try to correct things, probably overcompensate. So it was very curious to me to be making a film and what would it feel like to be shooting that? And so basically the idea was when you see Evil Angel, I didn't feel bad about anything that was in that film. There are only two things in my filmmaking career that I've actually felt like I did wrong by. And one of them was in Girl Crazy, and one of them was in Brigham City. And I only say this in comparison so that when people see Evil Angel and question, you know, to me, nothing in Evil Angel, it's a movie, it's silly.
It's a romp.
It's fun. It's a romp. It's fun, yeah. But in the movie Girl Crazy, there was a scene where the main character that I was playing is breaking up with his girlfriend because she realizes that he's been sleeping around. But also, she's pregnant now and with his baby, and so it's a little bit of a dilemma for her. But there's a scene where they're sitting down in an apartment, and I have the character say, the character that I was playing, you know, are you going to have it? You know, are you going to have the baby? I think that was my exact line. Are you going to have it? You have a choice, you know, something like that, you know. You have a choice. And I was always uncomfortable with that. I kind of felt like it was, you know, that because my own stance on that would be no. You know, once the embryo has begun, you know, once the life has begun, you don't have a choice anymore, you know. And so I was kind of, I kind of felt at the time like I was a little pandering a little bit to, you know, to another opinion or the more popular, the more politically correct, at least in LA, mm-hmm. politically correct opinion. Mm-hmm. And I did it, cut it in, and it was always in the film. And that's one thing when I watch the film now and I look at it and I hate that. I hate that line in that film because I feel like I could argue that this character, you know, is fine with that. And I have no problem playing characters that are murderers or whatever. You know, even though obviously murder is wrong, but something about that I allowed that to go through, and it was like I violated my own code there, and so I've always felt bad about that. The other thing I felt bad about was was when we were shooting Brigham City, and there's a whole story that could go into this, but basically, Wilford Brimley was just a pain in the ass. And I love his performance in the movie, but whatever was going on in his life, whatever, he was just, he is the most difficult actor I've ever worked with on any of my films. And I'm glad he was in the film because, again, great performance, but he was such a pain in the ass, just contrary. And anything I wanted him to do, he wanted to do something else. Just went on forever. And by the time we were shooting his death scene, he didn't want to die in this movie. I have no idea. He just didn't want his character to die. Didn't want his character to get sneaked up on. So I'm giving a little spoiler for those who haven't seen the film. But it got to his death scene, and he obviously hadn't read the scene before it was the day to shoot it. And so when he was reading it, he was grumpy, didn't want to do it. I was forcing him, basically forcing him to go through this scene till we get to the very, very end. And this was after, you know, several days of just constant conflict with him. And we get to the point where the gun's supposed to come in to the... He opens the doorway, sees the girl in there, and then the gun comes in. And he's supposed to... what I wanted him to do, I wanted him to turn to the gun, and then we'd cut away and we'd hear the shot. Explain to him what we want. We do the thing. The guy, the actual killer wasn't there, so it was just a prop man that was holding the gun. Sticks the gun into him, and so it's like, action. Okay, he opens the door, he sees the girl, the gun comes in. And I'm like, okay, Wilford, turn. And he just stands there, you know. Refuses to turn his head. So I'm like, cut. So I go up and I explain to him again what I want, you know. Same thing, gun comes in. Okay, Wilford, turn. And I was getting to the point. I was getting. I was like, please, just turn. And he wouldn't do it. And so I'm like, okay, fine. I don't need you to turn. Just I want your eyes. It turned out to be better this way, anyway. But I said, okay, I just want your eye. Just look, and that's it. Just look. You don't have to turn your head. Just look. Okay, and action. Gun comes in again. Okay, Wilford, eyes. Move your eyes. Wilford, look at the gun. And he just refuses. And it's like three. And finally, I'm so frustrated that I go to the prop guy and I'm like, give me the gun. Give me the jacket and the gun. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to play the guy now. And really, fundamentally, really all I want to do is stick a gun to his head because I was so furious with him by this point. And so, you know, we do action. I put the glove on. I've got the gun. Of course, it's an unloaded gun. There's no danger. But still, we did action. And so I put the gun to his head. And as I did it, I felt, I am the biggest jerk. You know, this is so wrong. This is so messed up. And of course, he didn't look at the gun. So I pulled it away. I let the prop guy finish it up. The end of the story is finally, you know, the gun comes in after like eight takes or however many. And finally, I was just like, Wilford, look at the gun. And finally, he just looks like this. Like, cut, fine, we're done. Move on. We're out of there. So we finally got it. But that actually, even though... What ended
was
up
that his
was
last
not,
day of filming too?
No, there's another so, one. I think. So another, still, another one or two. but that was the. I was so frustrated with him. But actually, even though that isn't a piece of the film, those are the two moments in my filmmaking career where I felt like I did something wrong.
Yeah.
And so, but not an evil angel. No, not an evil angel. Mm-hmm. And just to throw back another thing, Wilford. Yeah, excellent performance. So. I think it was his performance was pretty much worth the headache.
No, it is a great performance. Couple more questions on Evil Angel. If you'll give a quick synopsis of the Lilith and just the story arc, if you don't mind, and then just what's happening with it right now, what you would like to see happen next with Evil Angel.
Yeah, well, Lilith is based on the main character is the character of Lilith, who in Jewish mythology was a character of Adam's first wife. So when I heard about this story, it was fairly late in the game. You know, I probably only heard about it maybe 7 or 8 years ago, but the idea that there was this character who was Adam's first wife, but she wouldn't let him be the dominant one. And in lovemaking, mostly in lovemaking in other ways, and so she was basically rejected, and she wouldn't toe the line, so she was kind of cast out, and then God created Eve instead, who worked out, and then she became this figure who was kind of the enemy to humanity. And in lore, in ancient lore, she was, you know, if there was a death of a child, a baby, a miscarriage, it was Lilith who was taking this away, because she obviously was the enemy to any of Adam and Eve's offspring. So that's where I was fascinated with that. And she just became the character. I decided to take this character and bring her into the modern day and then basically have her be this, you know, she would possess the bodies of people and then until that body was dead, and then she would hop into another one and then just carry this kind of mayhem on. And so I brought it. Basically, I brought it to Salt Lake City. There's no Mormon really content in the film. If there is, it's pretty buried. And in fact, most people don't even realize that it's Salt Lake City. They're always kind of amazed. I wanted to shoot it in Salt Lake. I wanted to shoot it in Chicago, but I didn't have the budget for it. And so I just tried to shoot every cool old building that I could find in Salt Lake City. And I think I made Salt Lake City look pretty cool. And but that's the basic story. And there's an ambulance driver who's our main character who has accidentally gave the wrong medication to a prostitute who was diabetic, and he didn't realize it, and so she had overdosed. And anyway, he accidentally kills this character, this woman who was the host for Lilith. Yeah. And then Lilith has some business to take, so she jumps into another body, comes back to take care of some other vengeful business, but also just for fun, you know, decides to have some fun with this guy that accidentally killed her. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fun ride. It's kind of a longer movie for a horror film. It's a 2-hour film, and but the pace is pretty, you know, it's pretty good pace. And I had the opportunity to basically play with everything. So in fact, there's a one shot in there that I've never seen anybody do. I've never seen another director do, and I was very proud of it. And I'm also proud of the fact that most people don't comment on it. So
gonna share or not?
No.
Okay.
No. But next time you see it, just check it out.
Good.
But where it is now, it's finished. And the film star, the most recognizable star of the film is Ving Rhames, who was in Pulp Fiction and Mission Impossible and recently Piranha 3D.
And, I loved him in Dave. That was it.
And Dave?
He's the presidential bodyguard in Dave, yeah.
And where it is now, it's finished and it's hitting festival. We won several awards and festivals, but it's in a tricky and a risky place right now because it's ready to go into the marketplace, but I don't have the funds to get it out into the marketplace. So that's one of the things.
That's if you were to distribute it yourself. Your real goal would be that somebody buys it.
My real goal would be, to sell it to one of the studios. And it's definitely a studio.
Yeah, it seems.
You've seen the film.
Yeah, several times.
So it definitely looks like multiplex fare, but the only offers we've gotten from bigger studios are so pathetically low that I can't go back to my investors with that, you know, and say, oh yeah, we made that. Besides, the studios are notorious for not paying anymore. So, I mean, paying what you should really get, you know, creative accounting, and so basically what you get as an advance is usually pretty much all you're going to get, and the advances are nowhere near enough to pay for this movie. So yeah, I'm kind of left in the situation where I've got to put the movie out myself, which is fine. I mean, I've had some experience. I know how to do it, so I can definitely get it out there and as wide as I want. I have the relationships with the theaters, but right now I'm just trying to pull together the financing that I need in order to get the film out there. So really, that's what's holding me up. I would have loved to have had that film out last year, but it's just simply been a struggle with the economy the way it is, with my trying to work mostly with Utah investors. It's been difficult, and that's been holding up Falling as well, because of course I want to piggyback Falling with that. So hopefully within the next year we're going to get it out, but that's my main focus right now.
What's your dollar amount to do a distribution, minimum amount that you would need, and also your ideal amount to do the distribution.
Well, what I am doing with it is a unique approach. I need $400,000. I could do it with $300,000, but basically that is that's just the amount to release it in a contained region and show that it performs on par with the studio releases, and then using that data, it's a very scientific approach, frankly, using that data showing that it performs like a studio movie or a movie that would make $35, $40 million, then be able to go out and raise the $8 million to go out and pull in the $40, $50 million. So it's $300,000 to $400,000, and then trying to raise $8 to $10 million to put it out wide. But it's absolutely going to work. I mean, it's the same. I feel the same way about it as I felt about God's Army, where it's like, I know this is going to work. I've just got to get the money to get it out there.
Yeah, why don't you just take a second? Because a lot of people are at the end of this interview. I'm gonna tell you, there's people that want to support you and they want to support your work, but just in general, why is opening box office weekend so important? And you know, why is it so important that you vote with your feet when it comes to a movie and something like this?
Yeah, well, you're basically going into a big boxing ring. Well, it's not even a boxing ring because there's seven other people in there. It's like it's like boxing with seven other people. But you're mostly fighting for the space in a theater, so it's so incredibly important that when you open,
people should come Friday or Saturday.
Absolutely, because that's what makes the decisions on whether the film gets held over another week. Because if you have a week opening, a Friday and a Saturday, and for instance, you know, if there's eight films playing in a multiplex, and you're one of the bottom three, and there's three more movies coming in the next week, well, guess who's getting kicked out? It's the bottom three that are getting kicked out every week so that the next three can come in. And so, and if you're dealing with a big movie like a Harry Potter that's going to take half of those screens anyway, well, half the movies are going to be kicked out in order to make room for that. So that's why it's incredibly important, and that's why, for me, with States of Grace, it was a battle because I was always coming in like, you know, the last third or fourth and having to fight to keep a space, even a tiny little space, so that the movie could try to generate enough word of mouth that it would grow. And, you know, it didn't, except in a couple of theaters, you know, in the theater in Provo, we did really well because the buzz was good on it. But that's why it's so important. And that's why, you know, you're throwing so much money into marketing for that first weekend, first couple of weeks, so that people come out and it's a crazy model. It's really become crazy where the studios, they throw everything at that first week. And then, you know, and then you see the film drop off, you know, 50%, sometimes more.
But also theater owners make deals with studios that, you know, I'm going to play everything you release for my location for a few weeks.
Even with God's Army, I remember we were doing great. You know, we were doing, in fact, some people were taking us on, just because we were doing so well, where we would be, you know, one of the top three in the theaters, and then some of the distributors were calling the booking agents for the exhibitor. The exhibitors are the actual movie theaters. The distributors are the people like me trying to get it in there. But some of the people like, you know, the Paramount type studio were calling these people saying, we want that movie out. You know, we don't care that it's performing well. We want it off of your screens. And if you don't do that, you're not going to get Spider-Man.
Get our next Spider-Man. Yeah.
And so it's a crazy, you know, it's a kind of a crazy business. It's bare knuckle sometimes.
Okay. So right now, people can become a friend of Richard Dutcher on Facebook and learn what festivals it's playing at, and perhaps you'd catch it.
Right.
Festivals are giving you good reviews, so you're building up the critics' praise for when you do open it and all that stuff. But right now, $300,000 to $400,000 would be the real support that you'd look for right now to say, right, I want to have this have a chance to...
Right,
to
prove
really
itself.
Go places, to prove,
and it will prove itself.
And it's that per-screen average that they're talking about, right?
Yeah. So actually, some people, when they say, what's the best way for me to help you, you know, make more of your personal movies, it's like, well, help me make this
little slasher.
Help me make Evil Angel a success, because when that's a success, you know, you won't have to help me make my personal films, because I'll be able to keep doing that on my own and not risk anybody else's money. And it is important for me to keep saying that is what I'm all about, is those movies. But I'll make a horror film, a romantic comedy. I'll make a romantic comedy. I'll make a flat out comedy. Anything that'll help me get my films made, absolutely. And besides, I love all kinds of movies, so it's not like a big sacrifice to go make a romantic comedy. It's like, sure, if that'll help me, I'll do a great job with it, and I'll get to make something personal one.
Yeah, right now, are you open to making other people's scripts, or would you still want to be the one who would write whatever genre film?
No, I'd still want to write it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose if somebody came to me with a good script and the money and said, we'd like you to direct this, like, okay. But the preference would be to do it.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.
Still all my song shall be near.